Beloved Bhagwan, a monk put the question to Joshua, I have heard that you said that when the universe is destroyed, the Buddha nature will not be destroyed. What is this nature? Joshua responded by saying, the four elements and the five components. The monk asked again, these are the very things that will be destroyed. What is this nature? Joshua said, it is the four elements and the five components. Once, a monk was saying farewell to Joshua, who asked him, where are you going? The monk replied, all over the place, to learn Buddhism. Holding up his mosquito flapper, Joshua instructed the monk, do not stay where the Buddha is. Pass quickly through a place where there is no Buddha. Do not make a mistake and bring up Buddhism to anyone for 3,000 leagues. The monk said, in that case, I won't go. To which Joshua responded, farewell. Farewell.
Manisha. These immensely important dialogues have remained obscure even in the Zen circles. Because only a master, only a Buddha can give a right interpretation. Anybody else commenting on them is bound to fall far away from the right. These sutras are not written by intelligence. They do not follow rationality. They are not logical in any way. They are responses and to find the response, you need to have the same experience. That's why they have remained in existence, but uncommented. This small anecdote will explain to you. A monk put the question to Joseph, I have heard that you said that when the universe is destroyed, the Buddha nature will not be destroyed. What is this nature? The question is absolutely rational and right. But the answer needs a tremendous insight to understand. Josu responded by saying, the four elements and the five components. According to Buddhist mythology, the existence consists of four elements and five components. Now, this is an absurd answer to the question, because these are the very things the world is constituted. And the questioner is asking that when the world is destroyed, you say the Buddha nature remains. What is that nature? He simply says four elements and five components. The monk asked again, these are the very things that will be destroyed. What is the nature that will not be destroyed? Josu said, it is the four elements and the five components. Again the same answer. Now it becomes very absurd as far as reason is concerned. But what he is saying is hidden behind the words. He is saying the witness who knows these five components and four elements . He does not use the word witness, because no word is really capable of explaining the witness. So rather than using the word, he again repeats that the world may be destroyed, the witness will remain. And up to now you have not even witnessed the four elements and five components. If you go inwards, you will witness these four elements and five components. And the one that is witnessing is the Buddha nature, about which nothing can be said. The limit of language comes with four elements and five components. Beyond that is an open sky of witnessing, just a pure awareness. You can have it, but you cannot say anything about it. That's why he does not say it. He again and again reminds the person that language ends with four elements and five components. What I can do? This is the last milestone. Beyond this, what remains is the Buddha nature. And this is the way of Zen, not to say things in their completion. This has to be understood. It is a very important methodology. Not to say everything means giving an opportunity to the listener to complete it. All answers are incomplete. The master is only giving you a direction. Go into the direction of four elements and five components. By the time you reach to the limit, you will know what is going to remain. This way, if somebody is trying to understand Zen intellectually, he will fail. It is not an answer to the question. But something more than the answer. It is indicating to the very reality. He is saying you as a witness will remain. The Buddha nature is not something far away. Your very consciousness is Buddha nature, and your consciousness can witness these things which constitute the world. The world will end, but the mirror will remain mirroring nothing. But he does not say anything about witnessing, about the mirror. He leaves it to the person's meditativeness. The person has to find the answer himself. This is not a school or a college or a university. Zen is an opportunity for anybody to rise in consciousness and awareness. And the master's function is not to supply the answer. If the master supplies the answer, he is your enemy. The master can only give you the line to follow. Your experience will be the answer. This way of dialogue has never existed anywhere else in the world. Once a monk was saying farewell to Josu, who asked him, "Where are you going?" The monk replied, "All over the place to learn Buddhism." Holding up his mosquito flapper, Josu instructed the monk, "Do not stay where the Buddha is. A strange suggestion. Because the monk seems to be stupid not to see Josu, a living Buddha, before him. Obviously, he does not want to say that, "Remain here. I am the Buddha you are searching for." But on the contrary, he says, "Do not stay where the Buddha is. Pass quickly through a place where there is no Buddha." Because where there is no Buddha, what is the point? Pass quickly and don't stay where a Buddha is. Now he is not leaving any place where to go, because these are the only two places. Either the Buddha will be there or the Buddha will not be there. Do not make a mistake and bring up Buddhism to anyone for 3,000 leagues. He is saying, as far as you can go, 3,000 leagues. Do not make a mistake and bring up Buddhism to anyone, because you don't have it. So his three suggestions: first, don't become a missionary, because it is not your experience. That which is not yours, don't repeat it to people like a parrot. Only your experience ultimate eternal consciousness enables you to point to others to the same root. Still, you cannot teach Buddhism, because Buddhism is not a philosophy. It is a living experience. So if you have lived it, help others to join in living it. Share your life, your love, your compassion, your meditation. But don't teach principles. Buddhism is not interested in principles. And second, don't stay in a place where there is no Buddha. Because what you will gain in a place where there is no Buddha? You can gain some insight only by the sight of an awakened one. You can start moving towards your center if you see someone who has reached the center, and you see the glory and the beauty and the majesty of the person. Otherwise, there is no evidence that anybody has ever reached to the ultimate. Once a great logician of Bengal, Keshav Chandra, went to see Ramakrishna. Keshav Chandra was a very great scholar and he has founded a religion also. So he is a founder of a religion. He had thousands of followers. But he was always amazed that why people go to this stupid, uneducated Ramakrishna. Keshav Chandra lived in Calcutta, and just few miles away from Calcutta is Dakshineshwar, where Ramakrishna lived. And thousands of people will go there. He could not believe it, that what that man has got. And finally he decided to go and put the man right. Ramakrishna's followers were very much disturbed, worried, because Ramakrishna does not know any reason, any logic. He is just like a child, so innocent. And Keshav Chandra is a nationwide known logician, philosopher. What Ramakrishna will do in a discussion with him? They were worried that it is going to be a very critical moment. But Ramakrishna said, why you are worried? It is good that he is coming. Ramakrishna waited. Keshav Chandra came with many followers. He was determined to finish this man forever. So no followers gathered there at Dakshineshwar. And Ramakrishna danced when Keshav Chandra reached in his welcome. Keshav Chandra became a little shaky. This is not a man to discuss with. He seems to be crazy. He hugged Keshav Chandra and he said, I have been waiting for so long. Now start the dialogue to finish me. There was utter silence. Even Keshav Chandra could not say anything from where to start. Ramakrishna said, you start from anywhere. Whatever you want to say, say. I will love it. Keshav Chandra was an atheist. He did not believe in God. So it was obvious that he should start by saying that there is no God. What is your opinion? Ramakrishna said, it is not a question of opinion. If a man of your knowledge says there is no God, how I can deny it? To me, you are a proof and evidence that existence is not without consciousness. Such beautiful logical acumen, from where it comes, that very source is God. You are the proof. But if you say there is no God, I will agree with you absolutely. Keshav Chandra has debated with many people. He was a Supreme Court Attorney General, and he found himself completely voiceless before a man who has read only first two primary classes. And has no knowledge of anything, but the way he said that, if you say, I trust you, you are such a great rational being, you must have known that whether God is or not. I am uneducated. All that I know is to sing songs and dance and play music. I can do all this without God, but God is a good excuse. Otherwise it looks crazy. If I go into a house and start dancing and singing, it looks crazy, but in a temple it looks very devotional. God is a good excuse. Have you ever danced in a temple? We have here a beautiful temple. Keshav Chandra has never thought that in an argument dance will come. And it looked appealing because the man was so sincere. He said, if you say, a man of great intelligence, to me who is an uneducated man, I will believe it. I will drop all gods. Just say it to me that you have explored the whole universe and found no God. Keshav Chandra could not say that. Nobody has explored the whole universe. Without exploring the whole universe, how you can be so decisive that there is no God? Keshav Chandra said, I cannot say that I have explored the whole universe. Naturally, my statement that there is no God is not valid. But what about you? He said, about me? I have danced with him. I have loved him. I have threatened him. There have been times we have been on no talking terms. I sometimes close and lock the door of the temple and keep him hungry for days. But then I started feeling compassion for the poor fellow. I open the door, I bring food for him. And he is so nice that he has not said a single word to me. And he told Keshav Chandra that one day it happened that there was a sword hanging by the side of the mother goddess in the temple of Dakshineshwar. I told the mother goddess that if you don't appear today to me, I am going to cut my head. I took the sword from mother goddess hand and I danced from morning till evening. I told her that as sun will be setting, if you don't show me, remember you will be responsible for my murder. And as the sun was setting, he danced the whole day. A great crowd silently watched this strange man. He danced from morning till evening, singing songs of praise. And as the sun was setting, suddenly, the sword he was going to take in his hand fell from his hand and he also fell unconscious for 6 days. And after 6 days, he opened his eyes and he said, I have not asked that you should come into my deep unconscious. I wanted to see you clearly in consciousness. I wanted witnesses from the crowd, but you did a trick and tears were flowing from his eyes and he said, but now the world looks very pale. Take me back to the same space I have gone. You took away the sword and now you have created more trouble for me because now I can compare the tremendous beauty of the inner world and the tremendous poverty of the outer world. Just take me in. He said to Keshav Chandra, have you ever done anything to go in? Keshav Chandra said that I touch your feet and please forgive me, because I have come to argue with you. You are not a man to be argued with. You are the proof. If there can be a proof of God, you are a proof. You cannot be argued about. Keshav Chandra's followers could not understand what is happening, because he was the founder of their religion, atheistic religion, and he is touching the feet whom he used to call the idiot. Ramakrishna, used to send messages to Keshav Chandra that sometimes, once in a while, come back again just to finish me. Keshav Chandra said, "You have finished me." He renounced from the head founder of his religion. He said, "I could not argue with an uneducated man, but he had some experience. And I could see that I was absolutely empty, and he was so full of joy. I have discussed with many scholars, but the way he received me, dancing and hugged me, and whenever I argued something, he will again stand up and say, 'Good, very good.' He never used a single word against me. On the contrary, he said that if you say, I can join your religion. Because to me, you are also part of God. Any consciousness is an argument that existence is conscious. That is the whole meaning of God. It is not that God is a person somewhere. God is spread all over the place. In the trees, in the mountains, in the rivers, in the birds, in men, in stones. Everywhere there is a possibility of consciousness, this whole consciousness in its totality, you can call any name, you can call the truth, you can call the Nirvana, you can call the God, it does not matter. One thing is certain, that existence is not unconscious. That existence is not unintelligent. These dialogues of Zen trust in the person that if we give him a line, his intelligence will not stay with what we have said, but will go towards the indication. to the monk who was going to bring Buddhism to anyone, Josu told him that, please, don't do such a thing. You cannot share something with others which you don't have. First have it. And never stay in a place where there is no Buddha, because that will be sheer wastage of time. And don't stay in a place where is a Buddha, because that will transform you. You will not be any more what you are. Listening to this, the man understood quickly, must have been a very intelligent, understanding man. He must have looked Josu again and found the Buddha just present in front of him. The monk said, in that case, I want to go. I am going to remain here. To which Josu responded, farewell, farewell. Just go wherever you want to go. Why you are changing your mind? I have not asked you to stay here. He wants a clear-cut response from the man that he has recognized the Buddhahood of Josu. So these are very strange dialogues. They are not like Socratic dialogues. Much that is important is out of the dialogue, and much that is absolutely non-essential is talked about, and the essential is left by the corner to be understood. One has to be very conscious with his Zen master. Otherwise, one can live with a Zen master and miss. The master cannot give you anything directly. There is no direct way of expressing the truth. The master can give only situations. Now, this is a situation. Don't stay where a Buddha is, and don't stay where a Buddha is not. Now he is putting him into a dilemma. Then where to stay? He is not leaving him any place to stay. Obviously, he looked again at Josu with a more conscious, alert mind. And he saw that I was wrong in going away. This is the place where I should remain. So he said, immediately, in that case, I won't go. Jokingly, Josu responded, "Farewell, farewell." But the monk remained with Josu. How can you leave such a master? It is impossible first to find a master like Josu, and second, it is impossible to leave him. He will manage a trap for you. And once you are trapped, in a master's hand, your Buddhahood is not far away. The very meeting with the master is the beginning of your growing into a Buddha. A Zen poet, Isho, wrote, "Before the window is slender, jet-colored bamboos sing. When the cool rains fall with a rustling sound, their feathery green intruding at my desk, they know there is no purer hidden spot than this." Around the world, people have written poems mostly devoted to men and women and their love. Few are devoted to the beauty of nature. But Zen is not in the same category of other poetry. It is simply a meditative mind just watching around what is happening. And he sees beauty all around. The splendor of existence is so much that he feels to take a note in his book. Before the window, you have to visualize. Just visualize the window. Before the window is slender, jet-colored, bamboos sing. When the cool rains fall with a rustling sound, their feathery green intruding at my desk, they know there is no purer hidden spot than this." The poor Isho lived in a hut nearby the bamboos, and the leaves falling are running into his hut under his desk, and he says they know there is no purer hidden spot than this. Zen wants you to know that even the leaves falling from the trees have a consciousness of their own. Nothing is unconscious. There are different ways of being conscious. But we are living in an ocean of consciousness. Millions are the aspects so that we cannot understand exactly what the bamboos are doing. Now in Mukta's pond, two beautiful snow white swans have come, flown from England. Great visitors. And every night when I come and go, I cannot resist to see them. They look so meditative the whole day, doing zazen. Because they don't have any rented bicycle. They don't have to go to any movie. And they are so silent that if you sit by the side of Mukta's pond, you will become silent seeing their silence. They just don't do anything, simply exist. No philosophical argument. Seeing those swans, I remembered that in India, the man of self-realization is also called Paramhansa. Hansa means swan, and Paramhansa means the great swan. Every day seeing them, I could understand that they look so Buddha-like. Just enjoying being, no work, no job, no strike, no lockout, no interest in the whole world around. They don't have anything. But by their coming, the pond has become a temple. They are meditating day and night. For us, what is happening inside them is difficult to know. But something must be happening inside them. They are such beautiful people. But it must be in a different dimension. So we never crisscross each other. But in the same direction there will be other people, other birds. There were ducks also. Now ducks are small. They became afraid when the swans came. So the ducks were in a very trouble for a few days. Because the peacocks pegged them on the head, so they cannot come out of the pond, and in the pond two big swans are there, so unfamiliar, one does not know what they will do. So they were hiding in the bushes. But slowly, slowly, some communication is going, certainly happening, because ducks are coming closer. And yesterday, aves informed me that they have entered the water and they were with the swans. In silence, something, a friendship has grown. Nothing has been said, nothing has been heard, but something must have transpired between them. Either the swans must have told, come on, don't be worried. Or the ducks must have asked, can we come in? Something is bound to have happened, because suddenly it cannot be. But it is outside the area of our intelligence that is the very effort of Zen poems to bring to your consciousness that the whole existence is conscious. Different colors and different nuances and different ways, but to the man who has reached to the highest peak, he can see that nothing in the world is without a living force, without a potentiality that can grow one day into a Buddha. Buddha himself has told about his one past life. He was an elephant. One night, the forest suddenly got fire. The fire was going so wild, and animals were running out to find some place. The elephant also was running because the fire was tremendous. And just to take rest under a tree which was not yet burning, he stood. And as he was settling to stand there, one small rabbit just came under his feet, which was up. Now it was difficult for the elephant to put his feet down. The poor fellow will die. So he tried hard to remain standing on 3 feet, but an elephant's weight. Buddha says that because of that compassion, the elephant remained standing. He cannot put his foot down. The fire surrounded the whole place. He risked his life as long as he could save the rabbit. And then the fire burnt both of them. Buddha says, I was that elephant and I earned my Buddhahood by being compassionate. Now, all over the world, in the birds, in the animals, something is happening. It is not a dead world. Everybody is trying to move to higher peaks. This idea of evolution is totally different from Darwin's evolution. Darwin's evolution looks very stupid. Because we don't see any animal changing into any other animal. For millions of years, there is no record that somebody has seen a monkey suddenly going to the tailor's shop that I have changed my mind, I want to be a man. Now prepare the dress made to order. No other animal either is changing into another species. That idea of Darwin is absolutely absurd. But the East has a different concept of idea. The same evolution is happening in every animal. Something is evolving. At a certain point, when the animal dies, he will be born on a higher scale. Up to now, man is the highest scale that millions animals have reached. Amongst human beings, the Buddhas are the highest peaks. These small poems are just to remind you that even fallen leaves in the rain and in the storm are rushing towards poor Esau's hut and his table of writing and hiding under the table. And he says they know there is no purer hidden spot than this. Otherwise they would not have come here. This understanding that the whole existence is alive, conscious, makes your whole behavior different. Then you don't think of hunting animals, because they are your brothers, a little backward, a little uneducated, a little primitive. Killing them you are killing future Buddhas. Hence, the experience of all the Buddhas has terminated into a very loving and compassionate relationship with existence. Not even a tree has to be cut. It is alive. It may have a different kind of consciousness. Don't wound it. Don't hurt it. Because every wound and hurt that you do will have effects on you, your own evolution. Manisha has asked, beloved Bhagwan, the terror and the relief of having a master who promises to hit just for the joy of it, is this what Zen is? When rationality, right and wrong fly out the window, the mind is on hold, and all one can offer is oneself. Manisha, that's exactly what Zen is. There are hundreds of cases on record. When a master has called a certain disciple, even in the middle of the night, and told him that, let me hit you. And the disciple said, but for what? And the master said, because by the morning you are going to become enlightened, and then I will not be able to hit you. And it is such a joy to hit. And the master enjoyed hitting, and the disciples enjoyed being hit. It is a very loving gesture. The hit was not hurting. Somebody has brought me the Zen staff. It is made of a bamboo, and the bamboo is cut in between, So however hard you hit, it makes only sound, not much higher. I have put it with Ananda. So when Zen master Stonehead Niskriya comes back, he can have this really authentic Zen stick from Korea. However you hit, it makes good noise. It seems as if somebody's head is broken. But it is a very playful religion. It has made even hitting a joyful play. There is no religion in the world which allows playfulness and laughter and life and love. Zen allows total freedom in all the aspects of life. Zen has transformed almost impossible things into a very loving gestures. For example, Zen wrestlers you will see them fighting, but not with any anger, enmity, or any desire to win over. That is the whole training. Playful. Who wins is not the point. Who plays perfectly consciously is the point. So if you don't know, you may not understand what is happening. When the two Zen wrestlers come into the ground, first they bow down to each other. Because everybody is a Buddha. Before fighting starts, the Buddha has to be recognized. And you cannot be angry with a Buddha, you cannot hurt the Buddha. Both are meditative. While they are wrestling, you will not be able to see, but you can see the grace. You can see the silence. You can't see the violence in their eyes. And the master who is going to judge does not declare the man winner, just the way it is declared all over the world. You will be surprised, sometimes the man who wins is not accepted by the master as a winner because he lost his meditativeness. And the defeated one gets the trophy. Because he remained conscious all the time. Even in his defeat, he has won. Now fighting is transformed into meditation. Archery is transformed into meditation. Swordsmanship is transformed into meditation. Zen has done miracles Because nobody has ever thought that swordsmanship can be a meditative art. And when there are two meditators of the equal consciousness, nobody wins. The fight can continue for hours and days, but nobody wins, because both have the equal meditativeness, the same depth, the same height, the same love, the same compassion. Nobody is in any way inferior than the other. Only the inferior is going to be defeated. So most of the times, archers, swordsmen, wrestlers are declared to be equal. Nobody wins, nobody is defeated. Compared to this, Western boxing looks barbarous. The whole effort is violent, bloody. There is no respect for the other partner, neither any compassion. Every effort is an ambition to win. By any means possible, right or wrong. But Zen has created a totally different approach to everything. If the world understands Zen, it will be a different world. It is certainly the most alchemical process. So when I said to you, Manisha, that I will hit you just for the joy of it, remember that the joy is not only my joy, it has to be your joy also. Only then it takes the great quantum leap. Then the master and disciple are simply playing with each other. Nobody is higher and nobody is lower. And the master calling in the middle of the night shows his insight that tomorrow morning his disciple is going to become enlightened. He is just on the verge. After that, it won't be right to hit him. And it is such a hilarious job. So he sent his attendant that bring him quickly. He was meditating. He said, "What is the purpose in the middle of the night?" The attendant said, "I don't know. I just have seen him holding his stick. So I think he wants to hit you." other than that there is no purpose in the middle of the night, the disciple rushes immediately if he wants to hit. It is a special privilege. Otherwise, who cares? In the middle of the night, the old man is waiting to hit you. What more kindness, what more compassion. And when he reached, he said, "Aha, so you have come. You don't know, but I know. Come closer. This is the last hit." Because early in the morning, as the sun rises, you will be enlightened. After that, even if you ask me to hit you, I will not be able to hit a Buddha. That's why I had to call you urgently. The disciple touched the feet of the master and he gave him a good hit. And both laughed. And in the morning the disciple became enlightened. And there are not one but hundreds of cases on record. It is sheer playfulness. It is not to harm you. It is just to announce the disciple that tomorrow morning you are going to become enlightened. And obviously we have enjoyed for years, you will come and I will hit you. This is the last hit. It is a memorable hit. Remember this hit declares that the light is going to come soon. And the night is just going to be over. But strange methods and strange people, and perhaps the most beautiful development of a religious a small streak, it never could become a crowd religion. It could not be a Catholic religion. 600 million people will not be able to understand it. It is a religion of the only chosen few, because it needs great heart and great intelligence. Which very few possess. I am introducing you to Zen for the simple purpose that all other religions have destroyed your laughter, destroyed your smiles, destroyed your creativity, destroyed even the sense of humor. And life without sense of humor is not much of a life. Now comes Sardar Gurdayal Singh. He is the most religious person around here. I don't think if he dies, Saint Patrick will allow him in heaven. Just because of his laughter. Saint Patrick will immediately close the doors. That you don't belong here, just go the other side. All your fellows are there. I always think about that nothing can be worse than reaching heaven. So deadly people you will find there, rotten, skeletons, doing all kinds of stupid things. You cannot live with a saint even for 24 hours. And to live for eternity surrounded only by saints, I have told you about a Munich porter. Who was a good, happy fellow, just lying down in the gutter because he has drunk too much beer, and some mistake in every bureaucracy, some mistake is always possible. So the devils who had come to take him took him to heaven, because there the judgment is to be given where this man should go, remain in heaven or sent to hell. Saint Patrick looked into his files and found that this man has to be in heaven. And that man was continuously saying that just let me go. I have a duty on the station. I am a porter. But nobody listened to him. And he said, it is not my time to come into heaven. I have not finished even my beer. But they forced him, drunk. They gave him a harp. He said, what I am supposed to do? They said, here nothing is done. Everybody has a cloud. Sit on the cloud, float, have a harp, and sing Alleluia. He said, it is strange. I am not that sort of person. I have never gone to the church in my whole life. What kind of misfortune has fallen over me? But he was forced to sit on a cloud and told that sing Alleluia. Poor fellow has to sing half drunk, half asleep. And there were thousands of clouds floating like small boats. And every saint was doing the same thing, Alleluia. So the poor porter also said, Alleluia, Alleluia. And in between he will say, you son of a bitch. God heard that. He thought, it seems a wrong person has entered. And what kind of Alleluia? Two times he says Alleluia and then says, you son of a bitch. The God inquired Peter that look into the files better. It seems you have brought here a wrong person. And it was found that yes, he is a wrong person. So take him back. He was very happy. He thanked Saint Peter that I will never forget this kindness. Just let me go to my pub and I am perfectly happy. Don't send again any messengers. I am the happiest person on the station of Munich. I don't want this singing of Alleluia and harp and sitting on a cloud. It looks so stupid. He was brought back, left into the gutter from where they had caught him, looking around, finding familiar situation. He said, my God, what kind of a nightmare. Sardar Gurdayal Singh cannot enter. They won't allow. They don't allow any intelligent man there. And laughter is a sin. And anyway, you cannot joke with saints. Paddy is drinking a few beers in the pub and he has a worried look on his face. "What is the matter?" asked his friend Samus. Paddy drinks down his beer and says, "I am totally afraid to go near the highway day or night." "Why?" asks Samus, sipping his beer. "Well," replies Paddy, "my wife just escaped with a truck driver. And every time I hear a horn, I'm afraid he is bringing her back." One day in English class at Harrowitz High School in LA, Tom Robbins, the famous author, comes to lecture the class on creative writing. After discussing how to write a short story, he says, "Okay, for a successful short story, there are four essential ingredients: religion, sex, politicians, and mystery. And it should be concise and to the point." "No problem," shouts Bobby. "Babble brain Boris, young punk son, from the back of the room." And he scribbles something on a scrap of paper. He hands it to Tom. On it, it is written, "A short story. Jesus Christ," screams Nancy Reagan. "I am pregnant again. I wonder who the hell did it this time." A black couple, Luther and Ruby, and their 7-year-old kid, Samson, are having a hard time living in New York. Luther has heard that if you swim across the Mississippi River and make it alive, you turn white. So they pack up and drive to Mississippi. They are standing on the banks of the mighty river and they can hardly see the other side. The water is very rough and the current incredibly strong. Samson, the kid, seeing his parents' hesitation, cries bravely, "I will go first," and he jumps into the river. Little Samson is swept along but manages to struggle his way to the other side. As he steps out of the water, he looks down and sees that he has turned lily white. Seeing her boy's success, Ruby jumps in next and is nearly drowned, but with incredible effort, she makes it to the other side as a white woman. Samson and Ruby wave to Luther to come across, so Luther jumps into the raging river. He gets halfway across. And then Ruby and Samson hear shouting and cries for help. Then there is silence. Ruby is about to jump in to try and save Luther when Samson takes her by the hand and says, "Don't worry, Mom. It is only a nigger. Be silent. Close your eyes. Feel your body to be completely frozen. Now look inwards, collecting your whole consciousness. Try to reach to the center of your being. You live on the circumference. It is not far away. Just a great urgency is needed, as if this is your last moment of life. You have to reach to the center of your being, otherwise you will never know the taste of eternity. Just at the very center, you are the Buddha, the awakened one. Thousands of flowers start showering on you. The whole existence rejoices in your silence. For the first time, you are not an island, but part of the whole continent, of the whole cosmos. This moment when your boundaries disappear is the most valuable moment. the Buddha auditorium becomes suddenly a lake of consciousness without any ripples. 10,000 Buddhas simply become one. This oneness is eternal, immortal, the origin of everything. Everything changes only your witnessing Buddha remains unchanging. It is the very center of the cyclone. To make it more clear, Nivedana, relax, but remain alert, a witness of your body, of your mind, and all that is happening in this moment within you. The silence, the peace, the bliss. As you go deeper, the splendor becomes more and more richer. As you go deeper, life becomes a mystery, a miracle of immense significance. And a deep gratitude arises just for the sake of all that existence has done for you. It is not a prayer, it is a thankfulness. The evening was beautiful on its own. But your witnessing, your consciousness has added thousands of stars to its beauty. Gather as much of the experience as you can, because you have to bring it to the circumference, to your actual life. It has to become a 24-hour, round-the-clock experience. Slowly, slowly the circumference and the center come closer, and one day the circumference disappears into the center. You have attained perfect Buddhahood. Nivedana, come back, but now become a little more alert, a little more of a Buddha, a little more loving, a little more graceful, and sit down for a few moments just to recollect the path you have gone in and the path that you have come out. It is the same path, the golden path. And you have to live your experience in your life, in your activity, in your gestures, in your relations with people. Remember, you are a Buddha and you have to behave like a Buddha. And you will find great transforming forces entering into your life. The whole existence becomes supportive. Supportive for your metamorphosis. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, Bhagwan.